Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Nicholas Bain, your chairman for this evening, and I welcome you all to the annual lecture held by Government and Opposition, the International Journal of Comparative Politics. And this annual lecture also commemorates Leonard Shapiro, who was professor here at the LSE and former chairman of the editorial board of the journal. On behalf of Government and Opposition, I'd like to thank the London School of Economics and Political Science for the help that they've given us, as they always do, in setting up this annual lecture. Several of the political institutions which are studied by Government and Opposition have the practice of stopping the clock for a few days or weeks if they run out of time to achieve their objectives. And Government and Opposition has adopted this practice also, because you should realize that this is the 1998 Government and Opposition Leonard Shapiro lecture. I'll say a word about the 1999 lecture at the end. But we thought that it was more than worthwhile extending 1998 for rather more than 4 months in order to have the chance of getting Professor Bob Putnam to come and speak to us. Bob Putnam began his academic career at the University of Michigan. He then spent some time in the White House when President Carter was there, and then he moved to Harvard University, where he has been since then. He's held a number of senior positions, and at the moment is the Stanfield Professor of International Peace. He has written and published very widely, particularly on relations between politicians and bureaucrats, on the interaction between international and domestic politics, and on the roots of democracy. And he's increased our understanding in all those domains far more than I can do justice to in a short introduction, but I do want to pick out, first of all, his work on the G7 summits and the book Hanging Together, because I had the good fortune to be his co-author, and his very influential article, Diplomacy and Domestic Politics, The Logic of Two-Level Games, which is the foundation of the book Double-Edged Diplomacy. In 1993, he published his pioneering work called Making Democracy Work, Civic Traditions in Modern Italy. And from there, he's moved on to extend that analysis to the wider canvas of the United States, beginning with an article which was arresting both in content as well as title, called Bowling Alone. And since that appeared in 1995, he has been engaged without interruption in working, developing this analysis so that it will form a book which is shortly to appear. And he's going to talk to us this evening about some of his findings, which will appear in the book under the title of Civic Disengagement in Contemporary America. And after he's spoken, there'll be the chance for you to ask him some questions. Bob, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Nicholas. Can you hear me all right? My goodness. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be invited to deliver this lecture. It's a pleasure to be speaking to this group, and it's a little daunting to have not just one, but two of my co-authors in the room, Nicholas and Bob Leonardi, who's sitting down here in front, collaborated for about a quarter century with me, or I collaborated with him on our study of Italy, and many other old friends in the room. So it's quite daunting to speak in this setting to this audience. What I'd like to talk to you about a little bit is some of the things that I have recently discovered about the state of civic life in America. Some of you, maybe a few of you, will know about earlier stages in this research, and I apologize to you if you do, because I fear that there may be others who don't know the earlier stages. So I want to begin it used to be that newspapers published serials, novel-like serials, and at the top of every day's installment, there was a section that said, "New readers begin here." So I want to begin with a section for new readers, and then I will, I promise you, get on to some of the new stuff. In our work on Italy, which appeared as Making Democracy Work, we spent a long time on a rather obscure topic: why some parts of Italy were better governed than others. It certainly is a fact that there are parts of Italy that are poorly governed, and there are other parts of Italy that are well governed, and we asked the research question, what could explain that? We had many different hypotheses. We thought it might be wealth, economic wealth. We thought it might be levels of education. That's a conceit of educators to think that what they do might matter. We thought it might have to do with political parties. We didn't guess, however, for a long time, what turned out to be the secret ingredient, the trace element in the soil that made some places work better than others, and that turned out to be choral societies and football clubs, which I'm using as a metaphor here for various forms of community involvement. People in some communities were more, some communities had higher levels of involvement in political life, but also in social life. That's why I use the metaphor of choral societies to indicate that it's not just purely a matter of politics. Where there was a dense network of civic engagement, what had evolved was a norm of reciprocity. I'll do this for you now without expecting anything back immediately from you, because down the road somebody else will do something for me, and anyhow we'll all see each other on Thursday night at the Choral Society. And so the bottom line of that research was that if you tell me how many choral societies there are in a community of Italy, I'll tell you plus or minus 3 days how long it will take you to get your health bills reimbursed. It's a strong correlation. And we, it's also true that in those communities that have lots of choral societies and where government is effective and efficient and responsive to its constituents, those tend also to be wealthier communities. And for a long time, we thought that that was because wealth produced choral societies. By that I mean we thought that in a backward, economically backward region, peasants didn't have time, sickly poor folks didn't have time to do things like go to choral societies. But it turned out when we looked more carefully at the data over time that we had the story backwards. It was not that the wealth had produced the choral societies, it was the choral societies who produced the wealth. That is that the patterns of connectedness predated the diversity of wealth. If a region, for whatever reason, happened to have lots of choral societies, it didn't begin wealthier, but it gradually became wealthier. Those were also healthier regions, it turned out, and happier regions. People in those regions said they were happier than people in other regions. So we thought we had discovered the elixir, that choral societies explain everything, economic development and good government and happiness. I want to introduce here one bit of social science jargon. I'm happy to talk about it at greater length at later if you'd like, but this is not a talk about social theory, it's a talk about what's been happening in America. The bit of jargon that I want to refer to is a term, social capital. Social capital simply refers to the fact that social networks have consequences. They have consequences for the people in them, and they have consequences for the people who are not in them. Physical capital is simply some physical object that makes you more productive than you would otherwise be. A screwdriver is a bit of physical capital. So if you save your money and buy a screwdriver, you can repair more bicycles more quickly. That physical capital improves your productivity. Human capital, a term invented by economists about a quarter of a century ago, refers to an analogy between buying a screwdriver or going to LSE. You can save up your money and get a training education, and you, the same you, will be more productive than you would be if you lacked that human capital. And moreover, there are external effects. People around you benefit from the fact that you're more educated, you can be more productive. Social capital, by analogy, refers to the fact that there are features of our communities or features of our organizations that are like that. You, the same you, can be more productive if you have more, if you're involved in more networks, particular networks of special sorts, and if you live in an organization in which there's a high level of reciprocity. I imagine that's true of the organizations you work in. This is, after all, England. But imagine that you were living in an organization where there wasn't a high level of reciprocity, where you imagine there were organizations in which you had to look over your shoulder and worry about the trustworthiness of the people in the organization. You would be less productive than you would be if you were in an organization in which there was a high level of trust and reciprocity. So that's all that I mean, at least for now, by social capital. I refer to the fact that social networks have consequences. They tend to produce norms of reciprocity, and that tends to enable people to be more efficient. That's the end of the first paragraph of New Readers. I then went back to the United States after we finished the book on Italy, and was concerned, just as an American citizen, about a problem that many people are concerned about, not as a scholar, but just as a citizen, about the fact that by many measures, American public institutions, political and non-political, over the last 25 or 30 years have been declining in their effectiveness. Lots of measures of this. One common one is that if you ask Americans whether they trust the government to do what's right most of the time, when I was in secondary school and entering college, if you ask Americans that question, 75% of Americans said, yes, I trust the government to do what's right most of the time. Last month, same question, 19% of Americans trusted the government to do what's right most of the time. And that reflects basically a more or less steady 30-year decline. And it's not, I use the example of government, but it's not only national government, and it's not governments alone. It's also true, similar kinds of evidence on people's evaluations of the performance of religious institutions and unions and business and universities and so on. Effectively, ever since I started voting, America's been going to hell in a handbasket. And I was curious as to whether I could find a general explanation for that other than my personal effects on community institutions. And I wondered whether there was any connection between what I'd been studying as an academic, social capital, and what I was concerned about as a citizen, the performance of American institutions. And that led me several years ago to begin trying to see if I could find evidence, because I happened to be concerned about finding data on things, find evidence that bore on the question of whether there was more or less social capital, more or less connectedness, more or less community involvement, political involvement too, in the United States over the last several years. And what I found, first of all, surprised me actually, and increasingly then came to concern me as a citizen. In this little article called Bowling Alone, I reported some evidence, familiar things like the fact that Americans are voting a lot less than we did 25 or 30 years ago. There's been about a 25% decline in the fraction of Americans who vote, and that's true at all levels, both national and local and so on. And then I referred to, because that's quite important to me, that you I'm sure have already noticed that, I tend to use metaphors like bowling and choral societies that indicate that these things are, that politics is embedded in social activity, and I don't want to mistake what might be a broader social trend for as merely a political trend. So I wanted to get beyond the fact that voting was down, and I began looking at measures of membership in various organizations, membership in parent-teacher organizations, which has declined by about 50%, not in absolute numbers. All the numbers I'm going to be giving you are numbers that are, in a way, standardized for the number of people. Obviously, during the baby boom, there were more parents, and therefore there were more parent-teachers, parent-teacher association members. But I'm talking about what fraction of parents belong to that organization, which is quite important in the United States, one of the most common kinds of group memberships, and that the fraction of parents who belong to parent-teacher organizations has fallen by roughly half over since the middle 1960s. It was also true for what I came to call the animal clubs, that is men's organizations. That is a technical term which refers to the fact that most, I discovered only after I began doing this research, that most men's organizations in America are named for animals. They are called the Lions Club and the Moose Club and the Elks Club and the Eagles Club and so on. And all of those organizations I discovered had declining membership since the middle 60s, middle 70s. Again, not merely declining absolute numbers of members, but declining as a fraction of the relevant population. Similarly for women's clubs, and also for the group that gave me the title of the piece, bowling clubs. Bowling is big in America, actually. You know what bowling is? No? Well, it's you sort of throw a ball down a lane and knock pins down, and if you knock a lot of pins down, you win. And bowling doesn't have to be done in teams, but can be done in teams. I want to be sure I don't use all my time with this sports explanation, but it's important for cross-cultural understanding. If you can bowl by yourself, and bowling is a very, very popular sport. It's by far the most popular sport in America, participant sport, I mean. And it's the sport that's most egalitarian in the sense that participation is least correlated with social class, for example. This is a middle class, working class, upper class, not so really upper class, but middle class and working class sport. It's a sport that's equally participated in by men and women and so on. So it's an interesting mark. And normally there would be two teams getting ready to throw the ball down the alley. On each team had five players, so the total of 10 people. At any given point, there are two people up at the, called the lane, up sort of ready to throw the ball down the lane, and that leaves eight who are not doing anything. And they're in bowling alleys in the States. At the back of the bowling alley, there is a semicircular bench where people sit, and they chat. Most of the time, they're chatting about, you know, the latest Dallas episode or the latest, you know, whether he did it or not. In America, if you say whether he did it or not, everyone knows right away what you're talking about, and I realize that I've got to be careful. But occasionally people are talking about the local bond issue or whether the trash is picked up promptly or how the local schools work. So in a very, actually I think a very profound sense, but certainly in a very loose sense, what's going on among those eight people sitting at the back, they would never admit this, is civic deliberation. In part, they're having a conversation with other folks that they see regularly. And they know how to interpret, because Joe always says crazy things, so you know how to interpret what Joe has to say. Well, bowling is big, as I said. Bowling is up in America, up by roughly 10% over these last decade or so. But bowling in leagues, bowling in teams, is down by 40%. That's of importance to the bowling industry because it turns out that if you bowl in a league, in a team, you drink four times as much beer and you eat four times as many pretzels. And the money in that industry turns out to be in the beer and pretzels, not in the balls and shoes. So the bowling industry is actually worried a lot about the decline of league bowling. And so am I, though for a different reason, as I said, because of the declining possibility for civic deliberation. Well, that article, I think perhaps because of the title, got some attention. And we have been spending the last 3 or 4 years in America, well, been doing a lot of things, but among other things, we've been having a debate about the so-called bowling alone debate. Because the claims that Putnam made on the basis of a couple of gripping examples, seemed pretty surprising and likely to be wrong. And shall I get that or and people, other scholars have responded, and I've learned a lot from the debate. It's been a very interesting dialectic opportunity to listen to what other people have to say and to learn from their insights. And that's what I've been doing the last 3 or 4 years, and I'm now ready to try to present a more coherent view of a much broader body of evidence. And so what I want to talk with you about in the time that remains is present some of the evidence that I've been able to gather that goes to the question of what have been trends in American civic life. I should say at the outset, I'm very interested in the question of whether there are comparable trends in other countries. I've even, with other people, collaborated on some research on that point, but I have no idea, actually, whether what I'm saying is unique to the United States or not. In the time that remains to me, I would like to address four questions. What's been happening to civic life in America? Two, why? Three, so what? And four, what do we do about it? I'll try to get through all of those, but I'm going to spend the first bit of time, and maybe most of the time, on the question, what's been happening? Because there's some interesting methodological lessons in this debate. One of the first was that some people made the obvious and important point that the evidence that Putnam adduced didn't really prove what he claimed to prove. If you look at the membership in fixed named organizations, that is, look at trends in membership in one of the animal clubs, for example, that tells you about the health, the vitality of that organization. And I can tell you a little bit more because I've now gathered data on a much larger number of such organizations. I can tell you really what the graph for that looks like over the course of this century. It's interesting. I'll come back to say something about the weakness of this evidence in a minute, but the basic facts are quite striking. Over the course of the 20th century, what I've done is to gather data on the number of Catholic men who belong to the Knights of Columbus, the number of Jewish women who belong to Hadassah, the number of rural kids who belong to an organization called 4-H, which is an organization for kids in rural areas, the number of middle-aged men who belong to one of the animal clubs, the number of, and so on. That is, I've looked at what is called market share by marketers. And the market share of all of these organizations has exactly this, virtually the same form, astonishingly actually the same form. Over the course of this century, all of these organizations showed rising market share year after year from 1900. More doctors belong to the American Medical Association, more women belong to women's clubs, more Catholic men belong to the Knights of Columbus, and so on. Long rising graph from 1900 to roughly 1960. There's only one notch in that graph, which comes in a dramatic, catastrophic decline in membership between 1929 and 1934, as you would predict. Many organizations lost half of their members in 4 or 5 years. So this was a big effect. These are, by the way, all organizations that have local chapters where people meet. These are not just mailing list organizations. They're organizations where people meet. But then beginning a little bit in 1940, but then astonishingly, beginning in 1945, America experienced probably the greatest boom, organizational boom in our history. I'm not sure about that because I don't have comparable data from the whole of the 19th century. But membership, not just numbers of members, but membership as a fraction of the relevant group, doubled, basically, between 1945 and 1960. And that's true in virtually all of these organizations after World War II. It would be less surprising that there were more members of the American Legion, for example, the veterans groups. It less surprising that would show a boom after World War II, but it is, I thought, quite surprising that the Grange, which is a rather 19th century organization of farmers, showed a similar boom in membership, and that the Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts and 4-H, which are all organizations for kids, showed a boom, and the League of Women Voters showed a similar kind of boom, and so on. Until suddenly, surprisingly, mysteriously, all of them, almost simultaneously, began to experience stagnation in their market share. And then actually falling market share, although because the number of people was growing, many of them didn't notice. I mean, club secretaries generally don't keep track of market share. They keep track of numbers of members. And so as members, it took some time before people realized that there was something happening to their membership. And of course, the first thought was that they had done something wrong, a lousy program chair that year who just hadn't, or the dues were too high or whatever. And many organizations, for a good while, actually, engaged in, there are scores of consultants' reports to all of these organizations saying, what is happening to Kiwanis and why are we in trouble? If you step back and see that happening in all of these organizations at about the same time, actually, it didn't happen identically. The first of the organizations to hit the peak in market share terms was the the National Federation of Women's Clubs. And the peak there was in 1957. The last organization to hit the wall, so to speak, appropriately, was an organization called the Optimists. They hit the wall in 1980, but they've now plunged so much they're down with everybody else. So that's kind of strange. And it's even true for, astonishingly actually, I hope I'm conveying my own personal surprise, true for things like membership in professional organizations. Now, membership in professional organizations, like the American Bar Association for Lawyers, or the American Medical Association, or the IEEE, the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers, which is basically the trade professional group for electrical engineers, or the dentists. All of those show the same kind of pattern, rising. Of course, there's been a boom in the number of people who are electrical engineers, for example, huge boom. But if you chart the fraction of those people who belong to organizations, the trend looks exactly like the one I've just described. That is, rising until about 1960-65, the AMA, the Medical Association hit the wall in 1961, I guess, although they didn't notice it right away because their numbers of doctors was growing so rapidly that they were making up for the fact that they were getting fewer and fewer of them. But to come back to the point I started with, that evidence is actually not probative of anything. It's actually quite interesting, but it's not probative of what I wanted to prove, which was a declining propensity for joining organizations, because maybe there was a shadow universe of organizations which was growing up to replace these. Maybe I was just looking at the old-fashioned organizations. Indeed, almost by definition, if I were going to find an organization that had had members over a long period of time, they were bound to be sort of old. And therefore, maybe under my radar, we're growing up a whole new set of organizations, new age encounter groups and Alcoholics Anonymous and Drugs Anonymous and so on, that were replacing these. And so Putnam was looking at data that said people were dropping out of fixed named organizations and inferring that they were dropping out of organizations entirely. That's the first problem. And the second problem was, well, okay, suppose we accept that Putnam's right that we're no longer going to organizational meetings. That feels kind of square in 50s anyhow. But maybe we're just hanging out together, maybe even more. You know, going on picnics or hanging out at bars, or does the television program Cheers come across the Atlantic or not? You do know what I'm talking about. Okay, well, Cheers is the place where everybody knows your name. That embodies social capital. Cheers is synthetic social capital, because there isn't actually a bar like that. But if it were a real bar, it would be really social capital, just like the folks at the end of the bowling lane. But it was not that I was unaware of those two problems. I've described now two almost fatal problems to my argument. One, that I was looking at fixed organizations rather than looking at somehow a random sample of the potentially new organizations. And secondly, that I was looking at organizations rather than picnics. I couldn't figure out for the life of me how to keep track. I didn't even know how to estimate the number of picnics people went on a given year, but much less I couldn't figure out how I was going to estimate the number of picnics people went on in 1975. And I couldn't really figure out how I could get good data on how many club meetings people went to, not just to fixed name clubs where there was a secretary keeping the track of it, but that would somehow get the new clubs that were replacing, or hypothetical new clubs that were replacing the old clubs. And then, the most exciting thing that has happened to me in my professional life over the last, happened, which is I discovered not one, but two astonishing sources of data, which I want to share with you. The first of these, its existence was known, actually, although the data were not available for analysis, and we've gotten them available for analysis, consists of surveys conducted by a reputable polling firm called Roper, the Roper Organization, which every month for 25 years asked 1,000 Americans, a good national sample, every month, a set of questions that had the following form. Have you, in the course of the last year, done any of the following things? Have you, in the course of the last year, been to any public meeting at which there was a discussion of town or school affairs? Any public meeting at all, not just a kind of a council meeting, a formal town council meeting, but have you been to any meeting where, you know, parents talked about AIDS or about condom distribution or about curbside pickup of trash? And have you, in the course of the last year, been a member of a committee of any local organization? Not just a fixed organization, but any organization. Have you, in the course of the last year, been an officer of any local organization? You know, secretary or whatever. Have you, in the course of the last year, written a congressman? Have you, in the course of the last year, run for office? Now, few people run for office, of course, but with 1,000 people a month for 25 years, you get pretty soon it adds up to a lot of people that were being questioned, 415,000 people in these surveys. Well, in that large survey, you get significant numbers of people, so you can get reliable estimates of the number of people who run for office, or who've written letters to the editor of the newspaper, or who belong to local good government organizations, or who've signed petitions, 12 different ways in which you could be involved. And the astonishing thing about these newly discovered data is that every single one of them shows a massive decline over this period, a decline of about 40%. In the fraction of Americans who, in the previous year, had gone to a public meeting or had, done any of the things. Now, the declines were not even across every single domain of type of activity, and that in itself is actually intriguing and maybe illuminating for what's going on here, because the things that you could do alone, public things you could do alone, like signing a petition, you can sign a petition, or writing a letter to your congressman. You don't need anybody else's, you don't need to coordinate, you know, send it off. Or writing a letter to the newspaper. Those things that involved moving a pen, basically, where you could decide yourself, are down by about 10 or 15% over this period. Things that involve coordinating your activity with somebody else are down by about 40 or 50%. So going to meetings, if you go to a meeting and there's nobody else there, it's not a meeting. if you're the secretary of an organization and no one else belongs, there's a question as to whether that counts as an organization. So those things that involve cooperating or coordinating with other people, that involve just somebody else's action, are down much more. So that the story that we would tell, I don't say that I proved this yet, but the story that you would tell that fits this evidence is everybody's cut back a little bit, but because all of us have cut back a little bit, it's become much harder for us to get together to do things in a coordinated way. Well, that is a lot, because that data set is so large, it's really interesting. You can do a lot, that, and I will maybe have time to describe some of the things you can do with when you have that number of data over that long a period of time. But the bottom line that comes out of it is there has been not just fixed-named organizations, but any kind of organization has shown this same kind of decline that appears in the membership of organizations. And that implies that there, although there are obviously some new groups that didn't exist 30 years ago that do exist now, they don't begin to make up for the catastrophic declines in membership of these traditional mainline organizations. However, the other data set is even niftier. This is a data set that is actually, whose existence was not known before. I learned about it only by accident. A graduate student at the University of Minnesota wrote a term paper critical of bowling alone. He sent it to me, as some people do, and he had a footnote that there existed a data set that he'd learned from his teacher in marketing that might be relevant to this. So I sort of followed up that lead and talked to these folks out at this marketing firm called DDB Needham. They are actually, it's a worldwide firm. They, I gather, handled, I don't know if this speaks well or poorly, they handled the political advertising of the preceding conservative government in this country. I say that that's relevant because it's possible, I do not know the answer to this, but it's possible that there is an analogous data archive in this country. And it would be worth somebody trying to find that out, because it is amazing. Every year since 1975, this organization has asked 3,000 or 4,000 Americans a whole range of questions, most of which are whether they prefer Ford Motor or GM cars, or what brand of yogurt they like, or how do they feel about Adidas shoes, because most of what this firm is doing is trying to, you know, help write advertising. But somebody 25 years ago had the idea that it would be easier to write ads if you knew something about someone other than that they liked yogurt. You had to have in mind what this kind of a person is that. So they ask what they call lifestyle questions. And these lifestyle questions are really interesting. Lots and lots of questions about people's attitudes toward family, towards race, towards economics, towards politics, toward lots of things like that. But even more interesting, a set of questions that have this form. How many times in the course of the last year did you go to church? Now that's useful information for them, because they figure churchgoers probably send more Christmas cards. But it's also, this is the best data set in America that I think this is true, on frequency of church attendance. How many, but that's the simple one actually, because there are a lot of other data sets that ask that. It's useful to us because we can compare the two data sets to see, make sure that they're all telling the same story. How many times last year did you go to a club meeting? How many times last year did you have friends over to the house? How many times last year did you go to a dinner party? How many times last year did you work on a community project? How many times last year did you volunteer? How many times last year did you play cards? How many times last year did you go on a picnic? My ears perked up at that. Turns out I now know the answer. The answer is that in 1975, the average American went on 4 picnics a year. And in 1998, we've not yet got the 1999 data in, but 1998, the average American went on 2 picnics a year. So there's been a cut in half. Now, you've already learned a little bit about me. You know that I see this portents of doom in the fact that people are no longer going bowling. You can imagine what I think about the fact we're no longer having picnics together. But of course, how many times last year did you have a beer at a bar? Turns out that's down a lot, actually. And that's not there's a lot of evidence of other, I've subsequently discovered other surveys that show the same thing. Going out in the evening to a bar or a nightclub or a disco or whatever is down by about, roughly speaking, 30%. Now that's especially surprising because that tends to be single people who do that. And there, over this period, there have been many more single people in America. Marriage is no longer quite such a thing. So you would have expected that therefore these folks would be, you know, hanging out in bars. No, I don't know where they are, but they're not in bars. And they're not in any of these other social settings that we can find. Astonishingly, actually, I have to say, this is a really neat data set. One of the questions I ask is, how many times in the course of the last year did you make a rude gesture to another driver. maybe that's not a rude gesture, or maybe it is. I apologize if it's exceptionally rude. I actually know the answer to that, too. 4.6. Even better, in this data set, there is data on whether you cheat on your income taxes. And it turns out that there's an astonishingly high correlation. By far, the best predictor of whether you cheat on your income tax is how many times you gave a rude gesture to another driver. This, of course, opens up all sorts of opportunities for inland revenue as to whose taxes they audit. Meanwhile, back to serious work. It turns out that, astonishingly, these data, my greatest concern as they publish this work is that people will think I made this data up because the data so powerfully is consistent with the trends that I talked about in Bowling Alone. Virtually all of the going to club meetings, for example, going to church, going to having dinner parties, having friends over, going out to bars, picnics, and so on, all of them show a substantial decline, technically termed monotonic decline, meaning it is not that it kind of ups and downs and ups and downs and then finally hits a low number, but it's just every year fewer and fewer club meetings, every year fewer and fewer dinner parties, and so on. Card playing actually is interesting. You see, I just can't get away from these homey examples. Card playing is big in America. Even today, card playing, I'm not in a position to say this, card playing is actually much more popular than movies. The average American goes to place cards about twice as often as he or she goes to the movies. So card playing is big. And card playing has been, for most of the last two or three centuries, a really very common social activity. And it's been important. For example, in 1958 or 59, 40% of all American adults played bridge regularly. 40%. Do you know what you know bridge? Do you know the game bridge? well, that's actually, I didn't mean that as a cross-cultural, I meant that as a cross-generational question. Bridge, it used to be, as I said, 40% of American adults played bridge regularly. That number is now about 8 or 9%, and it's mostly confined to retirement communities. Bridge is essentially dying out. If you say bridge to an audience at Harvard, it sounds like whist does to the rest of us. That is, it's a vague game that you've heard of, you recognize it, but you can't imagine any real person playing it. And bridge is like that. And indeed, card playing is dropping at such an astonishing rate, even though, as I carefully reported to you, it still is more popular than movies. But it's those lines are going in such the opposite direction that a straight line projection has card playing disappearing from America in 2009, which is not that far off, actually. Now, there's not a trick here. It's not that I'm sort of picking out some numbers. It's just a straight line. It's been going downhill now for the last 20 years, and all it has to do is just keep going at the same rate, and we won't be, cards as a whole will be disappearing. Now, okay, that's not such the end of the world, except for the card manufacturers, but the reason that I think card playing is important is because many card games are intrinsically social. Bridge, for example, is a game that you're not allowed to talk about the game itself. That's called table talk, and that's not legal, but you're sitting there with three other people. You're going to do something, and most of the time you're talking, just as those folks were in the bowling alley. And at its height, bridge was, I think, probably the most important site for extrafamilial cross-gender discussions in America. Cross-gender discussions. That was an age in which gender activities were very gendered, but mixed bridge was common. Well, that's just disappeared. I mean, obviously we're doing other things instead. I mean, going to casinos is up, but I don't know, probably none of you have gone to a casino, but if you do go to a casino, you'll see it is anything but a social activity. It's actually thousands of people in vast rooms sitting, pulling, as part of my fieldwork search, So it is possible to play bridge on the internet. I've done that again. That's participant observation. I went into some of the AOL bridge sites to see what's happening, and there are games that go on with real people, there's almost never any side talk. It's really quite astonishing. It's mostly play queen of hearts, and then tick 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 tick, you know, little, and then play six of hearts, But there's no talk about whether the, and of course, it would, if you think about it, it'd be sort of crazy to talk about, you know, how you feel about the local schools, because it may be the person you're playing, first of all, you don't know who it is, and then secondly, it may be the, his local schools or her local schools are in, you know, Singapore or something. So that's not the kind of thing you'd chat about. So the fact that we've been moving a little bit, actually, we got to, don't want to exaggerate, because the collapse in actual real card playing is tremendously larger than the collapse in, than the gain in internet bridge. So, but even if we were just moving these things to the internet, it would not be nearly the same kind of social capital that I've talked about. So card playing, that's actually kind of interesting. We are around, all of us, I don't know if the same thing is true in this country, it would be interesting to know, but at least in the United States, we're in the midst of witnessing an extinction of an entire social practice, playing cards, during our lifetime. We'll almost certainly, during all of our lifetimes, that practice will become extinct. Actually, it'll become extinct quicker, probably, than in 2009, because there's a problem of population ecology here. When the number of people in your local environment who know how to play cards falls below a certain level, it doesn't make sense for you to learn the rules. It's a coordination, in game theoretic terms, it's a coordination problem. So at a certain point, it's crazy for you to learn how to play the rules. And in fact, it is crazy. I urge you not to spend time learning the rules of bridge, because nobody else will. So just like bird populations or whatever collapse at the end for lack of adequate partners, so card games are going to collapse for that same are in the midst of collapsing for that same reason. So it's going to go faster probably than 2009. I wouldn't absolutely bet the farm on that, but it's certainly going down quickly. Clubs, by the same token, clubs are going to the rate of attendance in 1975, the average American attended 12 club meetings annually. Isn't that convenient? One a month. The average American. Of course, some did more and some did less. That's now 5 a month. And it's declining at such a rate that basically clubs will disappear sometime in the 20-teens, or I don't know what we're going to call it, but the 20-teens is the expected date of death of clubs. Now, you know, those are kind of interesting. It's just as a sort of a social practice. We've been playing cards as a society since sort of the 17th century. As a widespread practice, or a little, some of it done earlier, but so, you know, it's actually have a practice that's been around for three or four centuries, disappear while during our watch, that's kind of interesting. Clubs have been around a long time. To have them disappear is also actually, but the interesting, if you're interested in things like that. But the most astonishing, the single datum in this whole data set that I find most astonishing is this. One of the questions is, how often do you have dinner with your family? Well, now, I introspectively can tell you that that's less, that I have dinner with my family less than I used to, but I assume that was me and my fault because I was a bad dad or whatever, or because my wife and I are both busier. But it turns out that the fraction of, the frequency with which people have dinner with their partner, the frequency with which people who have partners have dinner with them, is declined by about 30% over these years. Now, that's not taking into account the fact that more and more people don't have married partners, and I'm not taking that into account. I'm only looking among married people, there has been this decline. So more and more, we're eating alone. Somehow, eating alone doesn't have the same pizzazz as bowling alone, but it's actually true. Now, the reason I think that's the most astonishing fact is that we've been playing cards for 300 years as a society. That having that disappear while you're around is interesting. We've been going to clubs for 500 or 600 years. We've been breaking bread with our life partner together in the evening for a long time. I actually don't know of any society in which it's not true that family units don't have dinner together. So to have that disappear in our time, that's a big deal. You know, it's like some major species going extinct. Well, there are lots of other things to say about these trends, but and there's a lot more to say, and I'd be we'll talk on forever about this, the things that we're doing less of. But the bottom, and finally, I should say, and there's relatively little disagreement about this, we trust one another less. And there's a variety of different kinds of evidence, including some in the new data sets that make clear that the average American, in round numbers, if you ask Americans a generation or two ago, do you trust other people? 2/3 of us said yes, and now 1/3 of us say yes. That's in round numbers. So there's been a big trend in the degree to which we trust other people, not just that we spend time with them, but that we trust them. And there's some reason to believe, though the evidence on this is necessarily spottier, that we're actually less honest than we used to be. I've got Nicholas, about 5 or 10 minutes here to go on, and I've got 3 remaining questions. So forgive me if I skip past other potential interesting nuggets from what's been happening to social life in America and get to the questions why, and so what, and what can we do about it? And I'll just go over the surface very lightly here so that I can authorize questions from you or insights from you, because these are questions on which I have to confess at the outset, I do not know for sure the answer to all these questions. Why? Actually, it turns out to be devilishly difficult to figure out why. The technique that epidemiologists and social scientists use for trying to find the source of infections or social trends like this is to look for hotspots, that is to look for parts of the population to see where this might be concentrated, these trends might be concentrated. Who is it exactly that used to have lots of picnics and stopped doing it? But the reason that's complicated in this case, I mean, the reason that strategy doesn't seem to work in this case is that these trends are remarkably equal across all segments of American society. The trends are down among men and down among women. They're down among rich folks and they're down among poor folks. They're down actually at every level of the income hierarchy. They're down among PhDs and they're down among high school dropouts and they're down at all levels in between. They're down in central cities and they're down in suburbs and they're down in small towns. Now, the level of interaction differs across these places. Basically, women are more likely to be involved than men in informal social activities. I mean, sending greeting cards, for example, this is probably not true in the UK where everyone is civil, but in America it turns out that 80% of all greeting cards are sent by women. And an interesting statistical fact is that when two people get married, the frequency of sending greeting cards by the man falls, and the frequency of sending greeting cards by the women doubles. I draw no inferences from that fact. I report it as a statistical fact. It's true that, for example, going to club meetings is more frequent in small towns than it is in central cities, so that the levels differ. But the trends are the same. If we compare a small town today not with a big city today, but with a small town 25 years ago, the trends are all sharply and down in parallel. They're down on the East Coast and down on the West Coast and down in the South and down in the upper Midwest. And the trends, there's one exception to this, actually, that might be relevant. The trends are not down among older people. That means older than me. In fact, if you listen carefully, that's what the word older always means. It means older than the person speaking. And the trends are actually among older people. I'm 58 or something like that. Among people a little older than me, the trends are actually slightly up over this period. That is, comparing people who are 60 now with people who were 60 25 years ago, the 60-year-olds today are actually more actively involved than 60-year-olds were a generation ago. Let me see if I can put it this way. Suppose we line up all Americans along the stage here, every American, ordering us, by birth date, so that here we have the one or two people still in the population who were born in the 1890s, and then here we have the people born in the 1910s and the 1920s. You could put yourself along here, 1930s, 1940s, that's 1941, that's when I was born, 1950s and 1960s, 1970s. This is the baby boomers in here, and then down at that end we have the folks who were born in the 1970s and 1980s. And then we go along this line of Americans and we give each of them a little civics test, not how many senators are there from your state, but how often do you read newspapers? How many picnics did you go on last year? How often do you go to clubs? Did you go to church? Did you go to public meeting last year? Did you belong to where you were? We sort of test all these, give them a little test on all these things. Do you watch the TV news? And here's what we find as we go along this row. In this part of this is sort of the 1910 to 1930 part, the fraction of people who do all those things is very high and has always been high. This is what I call the long civic generation, high and to some extent even rising over this period until we get to the people born in about 1932, 30, 31, 32, and they're still quite active, but they're a little less active than the people born in 1931. And then the people born in 1933 are still very active, but a little less active, a little less civic than the people born in 1932, and so on, and so on, and so on for the next 40 birth years. So that if we compare the grandchildren who were born in the 1970s with their grandparents who were born, let's say, roughly speaking, in the 1920s, The grandparents are three times as likely to read a newspaper, twice as likely to vote, twice as likely to trust other people, three times as often. They go to clubs three times as often, and so on across all of these various measures. Now, you might say, well, that's okay. When they get to be this age, they'll be going to clubs and doing all those things. There's no evidence that that's true. In technical terms, there's no evidence that this is a life cycle phenomenon. All the evidence is that this is a cohort generational phenomenon. Now, what that means is, it's the only clue I've got, as to what might be going on here, but it's a striking clue, and it actually has implications for the future, because this long civic generation, basically the people who came of age during the Great Depression or during World War II, those folks are now, even though most of them are in their 80s and 90s, are now and always have been really civic. There's a long civic generation there. And they, for some reason, the folks who came of age after World War II, it's as if there was some anti-civic x-ray that irradiated all of us, which made us a little less civic. Now, one thing that follows from that is that since all those folks, that generation is now retiring, all of them are, even the youngest of them, are in their late 60s now, all across America, organizations are graying because that generation is not being replaced by folks from these generations. The average age in church pews and in clubs and in club meetings and in public meetings and so on is all rising. One of the things that the new data set allows you to do is to say quite exactly what's the average age at the average public meeting in America, and that turns out to be graying. And one thing that follows from that is that it's almost certain that these downtrends will continue for a while. There is, at the very bottom end here, I don't mean bottom in a value sense, I mean at the very youngest stage, there is some evidence of actually an upturn among people who are now in their 20s. Not a huge upturn, not bringing them back even to the people who are born in, who are now in their 40s and 50s, but bringing them up a little bit from the people who are just ahead of them. So it's possible that at the very front end of this long-run trend, help will be arriving, civic help will be arriving. But we've got a long way to go, because every year now, the Grim Reaper is removing another slice of the most civic part of America. And that is going to, for at least the next 20 years, 30 years at least, is going to keep driving down the average of voting. And voting actually follows, this turns out to follow this model exactly. Well, let me just speak very briefly about some of the suspects that I've interrogated in trying to solve this crime. Maybe we're working harder. We look carefully at that. That is a tiny, tiny part of the problem, because although women are working more hours outside the home than they used to, men are actually working fewer hours outside the home than we used to, on average. And so that can't account for very much of this. A tiny fraction of the total decline is driven by work hours. Economic hard times and economic discontent might possibly be a little bit of the story, but can't be very much, because over the last 25 or 30 years, the economy has gone up and down and up and down, and now it's in a huge boom. We're, as you know probably from the newspapers, we're in an enormous boom, but social capital keeps going down and down and down and down and down, just endlessly, it appears. So it's not likely that this is somehow purely an economic phenomenon. Later on, we can talk about other suggestions you might have, and since I have not actually convicted anybody yet, I'm open to new suspects that should be on the list. Urban sprawl is provably an accomplice. The factoid here is that for each 10 minutes of additional commuting time, there's a 10% cut in almost all these forms. That is 10% fewer dinner parties, 10% fewer club meetings, and 10% fewer church attendances, actually, which is somewhat surprising, because that means it's not just being in the box, in the metal box, the car, that keeps you, because if it were just that, then it wouldn't presumably interfere with your going to church on Sundays. But it somehow, urban sprawl has affected our, probably because urban sprawl has meant that the place we work, the place we live, and the place we shop are no longer as close as once they were, and that's probably fragmented our sense of community. I have to be careful about this next suspect, because my daughter, of whom I'm extremely proud and who is herself a professional woman, tells me that I'm very likely to express this in an incorrect way. But it has occurred to me that it's possible that the movement of women into professional life has had some effect on this. That is to say, it's occurred to me that it's my daughter's fault that Americans are no longer connecting. I wouldn't, and that's not, it is true a little bit, as you would expect, the data show that when women work full-time outside the home, that affects the time they have for being civically engaged. Actually, going to work has two effects that go in opposite directions. It exposes you to a wider world, so it makes it more likely, in fact, that you'll be engaged in some sort of semi-public activities, like being an officer of a club. Women who work outside the home are more likely to be an officer of a club than women who don't, but it also takes time, as all of us know, and that cuts down, it's clear in the data, that cuts down on people's involvement, but that is only, again, a small part of the story, because you can see the declines very clearly among categories of people who have not, like, can you hear me still? I've gone too far, too long? Is that why they turned the mic off? just tell me, Nicholas, and I'll. Okay, so I think urban sprawl is part of the story, but of course you will have guessed from what I've said already that I have another suspect, too, that I'm prepared to indict. I am not yet ready to convict, but that's TV, because TV comes onto the stage at just the right moment, and TV occupies a huge fraction of American time. And there, it turns out that in the new data set, among other things, makes it clear how powerful is the correlation between watching TV and being a civic slug. The most powerful predictor of most of these forms of civic engagement is the answer to the following question. You ready? You're going to have to answer this question for yourself. I'm not going to require you to answer it publicly. Agree or disagree, television is my primary form of entertainment. Okay, you've quietly answered that to yourself, right? Turns out that number is rising a little bit, not rising a lot, but it's rising a little bit, and that turns out to be enormously predictive. Half of Americans say, yes, television is my primary form of entertainment, and half say, no, it's not my primary form of entertainment, and that turns out to be a better predictor, for example, than education. If you're in the survey business, you know that education always predicts everything. But this is an even stronger predictor than education of degrees of civic engagement. It's not television news, by the way, that causes this. Watching the television news, not surprisingly, is done by people who are more civically engaged and older. The way to tell that is to watch what's being advertised on news programs. It's mainly health aids and denture things. I, by the way, regularly watch television news, so I'm for good or ill in that category. But that it simply reflects the fact that although watching television news is positively associated with being civically engaged, it's not. Most people don't watch television news. Most people watch other things, and those other things are. It's not clear from the data. It can't be clear from the data whether the television causes it. The only way you could tell that for sure would be to do an experimental study. If you think about it for a minute, that's not likely to be done because the U.S. government has regulations on what you can do to subjects in an experiment, and you imagine what that experiment would require: half of your subjects to be forced to watch television, and half of your subjects to be forced not to watch television. It's not clear which of those would be more likely to cause a problem, but we're not likely to have experiments of that sort. And therefore, I honestly don't know for sure whether television causes it or whether television is merely the convenient thing you can do if you've decided already for other reasons you're going to be a civic slug. Does it matter? The question, what causes it? I don't know for sure, but it's partly sprawl, it's partly two-career families, and it's a lot of it's television. And then it's whatever made these folks so civic. I don't know the answer to that. But that really, whatever they had, the rest of us don't. Quickly, does it matter? Yes, it matters in a lot of important ways that are not which is not a matter of golden glow, warm, fuzzy feelings for a period of the 1950s. That's not why this is important. In many measurable ways, institutions don't work as well in the absence of social capital. I'll be very quick here, but I'm delighted to give you citations because the literature is quite immense. Schools don't work as well in communities where people are not engaged with their communities, where there are not, their schools are not, where people don't connect with their schools. The crime rate is closely related to, here's the mental experiment to do. If you had worried about crime in your neighborhood and you have one or two strategies, either you could increase by 10% the number of cops on the beat, or you could increase by 10% the number of neighbors who know one another's first name. Perfectly clear, this is the more effective crime fighting strategy. And the fact that we don't know our neighbor's first name as well as we once did is an important part of the reason for the crime rates that are much higher, even with the recent favorable developments, much higher than they were in the 50s and 60s. So crime effects are not surprisingly, the higher the rate of civic involvement, the lower the rate of cheating on taxes, and many other examples like that. The one that I want to close with here on this question, this is the question, you remember, does it matter? It matters a lot for your health. A lot of really good studies of the health effects of civic connectedness. Control, and these are really good prospective studies, so they know which way the arrow, causal arrow runs. Controlling for your blood chemistry and your gender and your age and whether you smoke or not and whether you jog or not. Controlling for all the standard risk factors. Your chances of dying, well, actually your chances of dying are high. Your chances of dying over the next year are cut in half by joining one group. Cut in a quarter by joining two groups. This is the same order of magnitude as smoking, actually. If you smoke and belong to no groups, it's a close call. Now, if we had more time, I'd go over in detail what's going on there. There's partly a social support effect. If you go to church every week and then you slip in the bathtub, someone will notice that you're not there. But it's mainly not that. It's mainly actually physiological. There are blood chemical effects. This is the part of the story that you will find least convincing. I know that. Going to meetings lowers your stress level. I had you with me until now, right? Every time your department head calls another meeting, think he's doing it for you. Okay, I've come to the final. Do I have time to say how to fix this, Nicholas, or should
yes,
I stop?
Yes, you've got 5 more minutes.
Okay. Here's the story I have meant to tell. Over the course of the last generation in my country, a variety of technological and economic and social changes have rendered obsolete a stock of American social capital. That's just my jargon for saying the two career families in television and so on. We no longer feel comfortable going to the PTA or the Elks Club or the Optimists. And I think there are measurable bad effects for the United States that flow from this social capital deficit, this obsolescence of an important part of the stock, of our stock of social capital. Now, go back with me, if you would, exactly 100 years. It's the end of the 19th century in the United States. And we ask, well, what's the state of social capital in America? Astonishingly, the same thing was true then. At the end of the 19th century, America had just been through 30 or 40 years of dramatic technological and economic and social change that had rendered obsolete a stock of our social capital. That's just my jargon for saying that urbanization and industrialization and immigration meant that people no longer had the friends that they had when they were back on the farm, or that they had left their community institutions behind in the shtetl when they moved to the Lower East Side. And America at the end of the 19th century suffered from all of the same symptoms of a social capital deficit that we did today. At the end of the 19th century, America had high and rising crime rates, problem of degradation in the cities. Lincoln Steffens wrote about the shame of the cities, great concerns about political corruption, a widening gap between rich and poor. Indeed, the only time in American history that we are sure that there has been a widening gap between rich and poor was the end of the 19th century and the last 30 years. In many respects, America then, as now, suffered from the social capital deficit, and for many, fundamentally the same reason, that is, technological change had rendered obsolete the ways that we had come to connect. And then, we fixed it. In a very short period of time, at the end of the 19th century, most of the major civic institutions in American life today were invented. The Boy Scouts, and the Red Cross, and the League of Women Voters, and the National Association of Colored People, can go on forever on this. The Knights of Columbus, the Sons of Norway, and the Sons of Italy, the Urban League, which is a group of black people, the Kiwanis Club and the Rotary Club, and the Community Chest, and most trade unions. It's very hard actually to name a major, the YWCA. it's very hard to name a major civic the 4-H. It's very hard to name, I'll get off this in a second. It's very hard to name a major civic institution in American life today that was not invented in about 15 or 20 years at the end of the 19th century. Now, if you'd been around at that time, it would have been tempting to say, indeed some people did say, life was much nicer back on the farm. Everybody back on the farm. But that's not what they did. Similarly, if you're around today facing an analogous problem, it might be tempting to say, indeed, to my horror, some people have thought I was saying, life was much nicer back in the 50s. Would all women please report to the kitchen and turn off the television? And that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we need to reinvent the Boy Scouts. I'm using Boy Scouts here, and I don't mean that organization. I'm using that as a metaphor. Now, here is one point in the narrative, there may be others, where there's actually a quite close connection between British history and American history, because in fact, many of the organizations that I have said were invented in the United States at the end of the 19th century actually were not. They were imported from England, where they had been invented in the mid-Victorian era, probably in response to a very similar social problem. That is the Boy Scouts and the Salvation Army and so on. I'm not at all, hardly an expert on American social history. I'm certainly not on British social history. But I think if we look more carefully at this, it would be an interesting hypothesis to explore that there are periods in many countries, and not just in the United States, in which there are bursts of civic reconstruction. Now, our challenge as a society, and now you can see that actually I'm not really an academic after all. I'm really, in fact, a missionary. Our challenge as a society is to put in a hard 10 or 20 years in figuring out how to reconnect, not how to get rid of the television, not how to have my daughter quit her job and go be an ordinary mama. That's not what's at issue. We've got, but it's also not an option to say it doesn't matter. We don't need one another. It actually doesn't matter whether we connect with other people. There are measurable reasons that it does matter. Now, I don't know for sure what those new ideas will be. They're probably going to seem a little crazy. I mean, imagine the guy who came to town saying Boy Scouts was the solution to the fact that you didn't write your kids, the urchins here in the town don't have friends, shorts, and beanies, and badges. And it'll be just like the friends they had back on the farm. Well, of course, we know the inventions of that period that were successful. We don't know the ones that were unsuccessful. So there are going to be a lot of false starts. One of the features that was characteristic of that period of American history, quite interestingly, was that it was a period really almost unique in American intellectual history in which there was a very close connection and direct interchange between American academics who are concerned about public policy, public issues, and practitioners. And so some of us in America now are trying to urge a similar kind of period in which American academics no longer write only for academic journals, but also try to spend time learning from practitioners who are addressing these same issues. You've been an extremely patient audience, and I appreciate that very much. Thank you very much.
Really, really. I'm going to have a hard time sorting out the question.
Now, we do have time for some questions, and people already have got their hands up. Now, there will be microphones coming round on both floors, and I'll try and take questions from both levels. If I identify you, wait till the mic has come before you speak, and keep your question concise. And the gentleman with the beard here, please.
I suspect that one factor which will become increasingly important in America as a factor in civic disintegration is the exponential rise of the internet. Mm-hmm. And then a very brief supplementary. There's increasing reference in the literature to the fragmentation in the USA. Would you care to comment?
To the fragmentation?
Fragmentation, social fragmentation.
Can you just say one word more about, or one sentence more about what you mean by social fragmentation in that context?
Well, I think rather than divert, I'll withdraw that.
Shall I respond as we go along?
Yes, I think so.
The internet is, of course, an important part of the issue here. It's completely unclear to me, and I think it's unclear in reality, as to whether the internet is part of the problem or part of the solution or both. It did not cause this problem. I want to be absolutely clear about that. This problem, it's unmistakable, the evidence in the historic record is unmistakable that Bill Gates was still in grade school when this problem was well underway. So he didn't cause the problem. The internet may make the problem worse or it may make it better. Let me tell you quickly four problems of increasing order of difficulty in solving. One, access. This is the one that's most widely talked about. I'm sure it must have been talked about in this country too. How do you make sure that everybody, not just the rich intellectual folks, have access to the numerate people have access to the internet? That's a serious problem because it could divide America into classes even more effectively than we already are divided. But that, in principle, is fixable money. More, just buy more computers and have more handholding and so on. Two, bandwidth. Bandwidth refers to the space through which you can, the throughput. I'm sounding like a techie, aren't I? The speed with which information can transfer, or the amount of information that can be transferred. That sounds like a technical issue. It isn't at all. The real problem is face-to-face communication is infinitely richer in communication than text-based or even television-based communication. I have been getting lots of messages from lots of individual people in the room. I've been reading them the last hour and a half. You have not been saying a word, but I've been reading you. That's because I, like all of us, am genetically programmed to be really good at picking up information about people's, and there's lots of experimental evidence on this. We're really good at it. Probably it's because there was a survival advantage to being able to tell by looking at somebody's face whether you could turn your back on them. And the people who were not good at picking up signs were no longer with us. Well, the reason that's a bandwidth is to carry the information necessary to have equivalent to the same high fidelity information flow that I'm getting from you now requires a lot more bandwidth. Now, bandwidth is growing, but the use of the internet is growing even more rapidly. So there's a race between the technology and it's going to be a long time before bandwidth gets so out in front as to allow us to have anything like video phone. I mean, that's just a long way off, and certainly high-quality video phone. So that's the second serious objection. The third, even more serious objection, because I don't see any easy solution to this, is cyber balkanization. Cyber balkanization refers to the fact that what the internet especially does is allow us to talk to other people who are exactly like us. Not just people who are into old cars, but people who are into lime green 1956 Chevys made in Oklahoma City. Now, you can have a lot of conversations. There are lots of groups like that. I don't know how many of you are on listservs, but there are a lot of groups like that. And if you start, you're in that kind of a group, and you start talking about, you know, something else, like whether Clinton is guilty or not, you're people say you're off topic, right? And you're not supposed to talk about that. But that doesn't happen in the bowling alley. Imagine saying to the guy next to you that his comment was off topic, right? So what this means is that the conversation groups in the internet are disproportionately among like-minded people. And that's actually not the worst of it. The fourth problem, I'm sorry to go on so long, but these are an important, really, really important set of questions. The fourth is whether the internet will turn out to be a really nifty telephone or a really nifty TV. Whether we will effectively use it as a really nifty but essentially passive medium. There's a fair amount of evidence, including some experimental, recent, good quality experimental evidence in the United States, that the more you use the internet, the more clinically depressed you become, and the more isolated you become. And you might think, if you just did a correlational study, that was because people who were screwed up spent more time on the net to make up for it. But no, they weren't screwed up before they started being on the net. That's what this data says. So that's a serious problem. And yet, to conclude here quickly, if I reverse engineer and say it's the year 2020 and we've solved the Putnam problem, I mean the problem that Putnam was talking about how to get this back together, I can't imagine that we will solve this problem without using internet technology. So the problem is how we can bend this technology in ways that will be community friendly. I have some ideas about that too, but I've talked too long. So
question in the middle of the back row.
Well, it seems that your study has been concentrating on the declining trends of older forms of civic engagements. Do you have like also in mind that there might be emerging new forms of civic engagement, like cyber chat or like going to shopping?
Like the first was cyber sex, is that what you said? No, I couldn't hear, I'm sorry.
Cyber chat.
Chat.
Cyber talk.
Cyber chat. sorry, that was the... and I failed. that's sort of what I was talking about now. Yes, there certainly has been an increase in cyber chat. It has, however, the characteristics that I just described. And it doesn't begin to make up for the fault. I mean, the interesting thing about this topic, unlike Italian local government, if I talked to you here about Italian local government, none of you have any individual views about it, so you wouldn't say he's certainly wrong about that. Like, well, who knows whether he's right or wrong about Italian local government? But when I talk about how you spend your day, you all have your own experience. So this is a topic on which, it's one reason why the topic is interesting to lots of people, we all have relevant data. But the counter side to that is it's very risky, very, very risky to infer from your own experience to the whole of a nation, because we, people in this room, tend to be intellectuals, tend to be in the upper part of the class stratification in our countries, tend to be even more in the upper part of the kind of sophistication or the cosmopolitan fractions of our societies, and we are not at all typical. I mean, how many times did you go bowling before, right? Most of us didn't. I mean, even America, maybe you didn't go bowling. Not bowling is? Anyway, the point is, if you're talking about America as a whole, things like cyber chat are infinitesimal compared to the drop-off in picnics, even.
I've got a question down here in the front row.
Hi, I'm working here at the LSE on a project that's trying to turn some of this around, and we're trying to persuade and infuse and force people back into taking forms of community action. Basically, we've targeted that on people within low-income areas on the presumption that if you're bunging together out of necessity, that's somehow more important than people who are just getting involved in leisure activities. And I just wonder, have we got that right? Are we... is that right? Is it more important for working-class people to do it than it is for middle-class people to do it? Are we stigmatizing people?
That's a really very important political question, an interesting political question. There's a lot to be said, but let me try to just speak telegraphically. I don't do that easily, but let me try to speak telegraphically about the answer. One, insofar as the trends in the United States are any guide, the trends are actually completely equal at all levels of the class hierarchy. There's one set of critics to my work has said, no, he's got it wrong, he's only navel-gazing, it's only the upper middle class has dropped out. And another set of critics would say, he's got it wrong, it's the lower class that are dropping out. But as far as I can read the data, everybody's dropping out. Now, that doesn't mean we should worry about it quite as much for upper class folks, because we began at a higher level of civic engagement and still have a higher level. So in absolute terms, we're obviously much better off. Social capital is probably at least as unequally distributed across people as other forms of capital. And so if I were, allocating my time and energy in general, I would worry about the allocation to the lower part of the income distribution. However, your question allows me to say, and really demands that I make an important qualification that I have not made so far, and I really, forgive me if I interrupt, take your question as an opportunity to do this. I've been talking about social capital as if it were a single thing. You could have a lot of it or a little of it. That's not true. There are many different forms of social capital with many different characteristics. An important distinction among types of social capital is the distinction between bridging social capital and bonding social capital. Bonding social capital is social capital that brings you together with people like you. Bridging social capital is social capital that brings you together with people unlike you. It's much easier to build bonding social capital than to build bridging social capital. On the whole, my intuition is that bridging social capital is more important for social life. Here's a question I pose sometimes to American audiences, and I don't know if it'll work in this audience, but let me try. If I had a golden magic wand and I could wave over the United States that would create more bridging social capital, more working class and middle class people going bowling together, more blacks and whites going to church together, and so on, and I took a vote, should I use the golden magic wand
in most American audiences, the vote is overwhelming. Yes, go ahead, use the magic wand, wave the wand, and have more Americans connect with people unlike themselves. But it turns out I don't have the golden magic wand. I've got an aluminum magic wand. This aluminum magic wand creates more social capital, but only more bonding social capital. That is, more blacks and whites go to church, but not to the same church. More working class and middle class people go bowling, but not to the same leagues. And then the question is, should I use the aluminum magic wand? Now, keep in mind the question not, should I use the gold one or the aluminum one? That's easy, use the gold one. But if I don't have the aluminum one, what I have just asked you is, in other terms is, what do you think about having bonding social capital? What is the net positive and the negatives of more bonding social capital? That is a tough question. That's not an easy question. It's a deeply moral question. And it's a way of phrasing, I think, the question. In part, I think that what's most needed, politically as well as anything else, is more bridging social capital. Because I worry that if all we concentrate, some people say that, no, this is, social capital is an anti-political agenda. It's just getting people together to go bowling and doesn't get them interested in politics. I think that's precisely wrong. The only way that we're going to get a majority, a progressive majority in the United States, and now I really am revealing my political views, the only way we're going to get a progressive majority in the United States is if we build more civic engagement and particularly more bridging social capital. Because the white suburbanites are not going to just vote out of the goodness of their heart unless they know other people like that are really involved. So I think that just as in the end of the 19th century, building social capital was a prerequisite to politics. That's what the labor leaders in this country were doing at the end of the 19th century. They were building social capital as a prerequisite for political progress. That, I think, is a challenge for progressives today.
Now, I've got a question up there on the two rows back on the upper level.
Hello. My question is, do you think that one of the reasons for this phenomenon is the decreasing level of faith that people have, the religious affiliation or any kind of faith or ideology that people ascribe to?
I'm not sure that I heard the question right. Do I think it's space, you say?
Faith.
Oh, faith. I'm sorry. I beg your pardon. Yes, I do think that that's part of the story. For a good liberal like me, liberal in the American sense, that's a tough answer to have given to you. And for several reasons. It's pretty clear that religion is a big part of American social life. As a rough rule of thumb, half of all social activity in America is religious. Half of all volunteering is religious, half of all philanthropy is religious, half of all club memberships are religious. So you can't address the question of social capital in the United States, at least, without addressing the question of religion, the social dimensions of religion. Secondly, as I look historically, most of the cases of dramatic increases in world history in social capital are associated with religious revivals. I won't say all of them, but most of the cases of major social capital creation are religious in character. I'm not deeply religious myself, I should say, it may be obvious. But as I observe this, I have become deeply respectful of religion and think that it's a mistake for those of us who are observing it to think that when we are talking sociologically about religion, we can ignore the faith part, because I think people who are in the faith think that's not something else, you know, that we could be going to a baseball league, we decided to go to church instead. That's an important part of why religion is such a powerful generator of reciprocity. It's quite clear that a very strong predictor of whether you give blood and whether you, lots of forms of civic engagement are predicted by religious involvement. Controlling for everything else. This is not something spurious. So yes is the answer. I think it's quite an important part of the problem. And yet, just to add yet another layer of complexity here, I worry a lot about whether more social capital means less tolerance. There's some reason to think that social capital means intolerance. In general, that's not true. Empirically, people who belong to more clubs or whatever are more tolerant of people unlike them. If you take belonging even to something like the American Legion, which is a moderately conservative organization of American veterans, belonging to that, controlling for everything else, is actually positively associated with tolerance, not negatively. They're not very tolerant, but compared to other middle-aged men, but compared to other middle-aged men who don't belong to the club, they're tolerant. That's true for most organizations, that tolerance is positively correlated with social capital. One exception is religion. The more engaged you are in religion, the less tolerant you are of other people. So that's why I paused and answered your question. I don't see how we can solve the problem without taking faith seriously on its own terms, but I do worry that that might end up producing, in fact, less bridging social capital.
Now, I think there's a question in the front row on the upper level with the green scarf. Yes.
I wondered why you didn't mention, or maybe you please explain to me, the long time span you oversaw the workers' movement and the unions and the political movements. I mean, the time span you were covering, parties were invented, unions were invented, played a big role in creating the society you talked about, and they have been becoming less important or vanished. Had you looked into that as well? And
yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. I didn't cite that, frankly, by oversight, not because, I mean, and in the book there's a whole discussion of that. The problem of doing a lecture like this extemporaneously is you forget to say things, and I should have said something about it. Unions are clearly fit the example I've talked about. There's been a huge decline in union membership. The union membership tracks the story that I told exactly. It booms in the first part of the century, and then it declines at exactly the same time period. And I absolutely agree that that was an important, very important, the most important form of organizational involvement for people in the working class, working class men in the United States for a long period of time. So that's very true. American party history, as you probably know, is different from European party history. American parties go back earlier than that, so they were not invented in that. Mass parties were not invented in that period. Indeed, mass parties in the United States, oddly enough, were beginning to crumble at that period. And if this were a talk in which we were talking about the details of the late 19th century civic life in America, I would need to grapple with the fact that at the very time that all of these other organizations were being invented, political parties as organizational types were becoming weaker. I do, however, there was one reason why I didn't put parties and organization and labor organizations front and center, and that is because I want to make the point that this is not a purely political phenomenon. And I want to make the point that if you look at the late 19th century in America, just as union organization was important, so too were the organization of women's reading groups. Politically important, because women's reading groups organizationally became the basis for the suffrage movement in the United States. And you could find that you could find example after example. I don't want to quite claim that bowling leagues will turn out to be the root of revolution in the United States, but it is certainly true that, at least in my view, this kind of civic sinews that I'm talking about is a prerequisite for organized political action.
I'm going to take only one more question, I'm afraid. It's a hard choice, but I'll take the gentleman in the back row there in the orange trousers. And this, I'm afraid, will have to be the last question.
Hi. Assuming that the U.S. Enjoys, it's economically more developed than in 1960, how can you explain an increasing economic prosperity with a social declining capital?
Well, there are a lot of other things that, do you know the law of the hammer? The law of the hammer is if you give a boy a hammer, everything is a nail. Social capital is my hammer. You give me a problem and I see a social capital dimension to it. You've already known that from the rest of the discussion. But I do not think that it's the only thing that affects economic development. I think there are lots of other things, too, that influence economic development. And, for example, pace of technological invention is very important, and rates of investment in human capital. America has had an enormous, humongous increase in investment in human capital over exactly that period, a huge increase in the fraction of the American population that has advanced education during precisely the period you're talking about. And of course, we've been investing financially too. And there are lots of other things that are relevant here, like the allocations, mechanisms for allocating capital and labor and so on. So there's a lot of things. I do not, even though I self-caricature here, even though I think social capital is really important, I don't think it's the only thing that's relevant to American economic life.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to bring this session reluctantly to a close. But on your behalf, Bob, I want to thank you very much. You've surprised us. You've made us laugh. But you most of all made us think, because your analysis is very subtle, but it's also very accessible. And it's about things that are very important to all of us. And even though this is the United Kingdom and not the United States, we can all recognize the phenomena that you've been describing. And you've set a high standard for the 1999 government and opposition lecturer to follow. And he, I contend you, will be Anthony Giddens, the director of this school. Bob, you're going to come and spend part of the weekend with us, so we're obviously going to have to make sure you have lots of socially capital-enhancing activities. We've arranged a dinner party, and we must have a picnic, and you, you may even be able to have dinner with your wife. ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this session, but please show your appreciation to the lecturer.
Thank you very much. That was really, really, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. My goodness, thank you.